So I would like to share some reflections. I'm hoping the going out for a misty shower is freshening to all of your cells, to your hearts. As someone was speaking yesterday, a bit about asking, well, what is the point of meditation? I would say it really feels like it's not that suddenly one would become someone with no problems, who's perfect or anything. I would say that maybe things stick a bit less inside, you know, that just that feeling that things kind of can just pass through a little easier by moments, and it's not a blanket statement at all, but just that feeling of a little bit more fluidity of not holding quite so tightly to when there is a problem or difficulty, painful feeling, whatever. It's like there's less for it to get stuck on. I have a very strange image, but I think it's a bit too full on, so I won't say it. Maybe I'll save it to the end of the retreat when things are really fluid. And as I was saying, I think on the first talk, you know, the purpose, the really deep purpose of meditation is to quieten the sense of self. Not as in quieten down, shut up, repress, put a cover on in any way. To quieten that, the painfulness of that sense of self being like that feeling when someone slams the door, you know, that that inside feeling like a sudden clench, you know, that feeling is like the sense of self, like when somebody does something and it is so unjust and we get that really feeling, you know. In all its variations and degrees of intensity. But that very strong sense of being someone very solid that has something very important to defend. Just that's a little intro of that. And as we were speaking over the last 2 days of hindrances, these hindrances, they've got such a bad name, really. It's no good at all, you know. Maybe we could find something else on this retreat to call them. Because that thing of thinking that they're hindrances and we need to get rid of them is really not helpful. It's like throwing the tools away, you know, to be able to sweep the path, our spiritual path. That is, chuck the broom away and be done with it, you know. But they're like, they're almost like, but it's difficult to feel into sometimes, because the hindrances feel like they are manifestations in a sense of the sense of self. It's like what we sit down, what is distracting us in meditation is often a manifestation of the sense of self. Something that you want or you don't want, or that eternal doubting mind, you know. Or that I just can't deal with this, so I want to space out and fall asleep. Or the anxiety of, you know, things not okay, not okay, not okay for me. They're all manifestations of that. And the reason why the hindrances are such actually wonderful tools is that through these hindrances coming up, we can look into the nature of them and our reactions to them and notice that how impermanent they are. Notice the unsatisfactoriness of this life. Not meaning, oh, terrible life is all suffering. Just that as human beings, you know, we have a whole range from, like deep freaked outness that obviously has its reason to mild irritation. You know, we have the whole spectrum. It's not life is suffering. It's there just is suffering. There is a certain level of things not quite right often, just as human beings. And so these hindrances are really great tools in that way. Of as they come up, if you can be with, like if you have a strong desire, if you can be with that and connect with that, it will pass. It is impermanent. You know, any strong, intense emotion, feeling, thought, they actually pass. Actually, most emotions last 90 seconds. And then it depends what we add, you know, what stories we add on to that. Most of the time, if we really go inside, like go right into the eye of the storm, of a strong feeling, sometimes we can't find it anymore. It kind of fritters away. And if in that strong emotion we look for where I am, where am I? Because it often feels like we're completely taken up. It's taken up our whole body and being, whatever the strong emotion is. When you look for meanness inside of that, you can't really find it. So that's an interesting exploration, you know. To just take your name and be having a strong emotion and go, ah, but where is noonness in there? Can I feel the noonness? Often it's a kind of, it doesn't actually have that colour of noonness. If you really get really into a thought, you know, a feeling, a sensation, an emotion, it doesn't actually, it's not really yours. But it's happening. And that's where we have to be careful of, as Sumedha was speaking about, spiritual bypassing, you know. We are having the experience of that. And so often it needs attending to. It needs welcoming and investigating. And not pushing away, pushing down, or making out we're brave and emotions don't happen to us. It needs acknowledging and, hello, come in, yes. Often I find a helpful practice is feeling in with the body to what is wholesome and unwholesome. So in a sense, we know what is healthy. We already have that wisdom in our bodies. So to have something going on and to just stop and connect with it and go, is this healthy? Is this wholesome? Your body knows what is wholesome. Do you feel that? That when you really close your eyes, is this wholesome? There's normally a response I find that's quite clear, actually. I really, I got a taste of it when, like some, maybe 11, 12 years ago, I was again trying to give up smoking. And I'd been trying for 10 years to give up smoking, and I tried hypnotism and patches and this's and that's's, all sorts of things that had failed. And each time that I tried and I started again, I felt terrible about myself. I just felt like I was the worst, and I didn't have any stamina and strength and all of this kind of thing. And then I was getting really into these Buddhist practices and the practice of non-self. And so one was like seeing through the identity of being someone who was so addicted to something that they couldn't give it up. And seeing through that identity that it wasn't true. It just wasn't true that I was that person. It was a construct, you know. That I was looking after. I was looking after that identity of the addict who couldn't give up. Because that suited me to not give up, you know. And I spent the last year, because a friend of mine, and she still smokes now, which is funny. But I spent the last year of my cigarette career where I promised myself, I lived in a caravan. I promised myself that I wouldn't smoke inside because I couldn't stand the damn smell on my clothes and my hair and everything. It was gruesome. And so I smoked outside in the winter, in the cold, in front of my caravan, under the awning, you know, freezing. And I spent this last year consciously tasting every single cigarette, every single puff of the cigarette, and really feeling into, is this wholesome? Is this wholesome? That tar tree coming down. The gruesome cough, you know, the whole lot. The smell, the taste, the feeling you finished it after the craving for that nicotine hit, and then afterwards, emptiness, no satisfaction. You know? And that was quite an extreme way to feel into that wholesome, not wholesome in the body. And there are many ways of doing it, maybe in a, many subtle forms of that. That can be helpful. That's the kind of easy one. And when I stopped, I wasn't giving up. I was free. So I didn't have the impression of relinquishing of something being an effort, but I was losing something. I had a sudden feeling of freedom, and it was just like a burst, like an unlocking of something. And I didn't suffer. That time, the last time, I didn't suffer one little bit. Every bit was celebration. I am finally free. Because I'd started smoking in a cupboard when I was 8 years old, you know. Amongst many other addictions and stuff like that. But even for that kind of really highly visible stuff, but also for the more subtle, it was likened by I asked somebody once, the abbot of Amaravati, Ajahn Amaro, about what we do once we're kind of in the cycle already of some sort of delusion or something. And he said to me this funny way of looking at it. It's like a train, you know. And sometimes you get on the train and then you get this feeling and you ask someone, is this train going to, you know, wherever? And they go, no. And you grab your bags and you jump off quick, you know. And sometimes it can be like that, you know, with a train of thought that is not wholesome, getting on a trip about something, some ill will thing with someone, some stuff, where there's time to still get off the train, because the train hasn't left the platform yet. And sometimes the train has left when you say, is this train going to... And somebody goes, no way. Like, oh, no, no. And then you have to wait till the next station to get off and come back. Okay? And then it's so important to be kind to yourself when you've started that cycle and you've gone into some repertoire of like some pattern of irritability or response to someone. A little bit like my mum, who just has been trying to phone me today. And I said, it's like she knows, I've told her many times, I'm going to England to do a retreat, and I'll be back on this date. And there's all these messages, and she's trying to ring me. And I'm like, Mum, I'm in silence. Mum, I told you I was going on a retreat. I can't see. Are you on the bus, darling? Mum, I told you I was going to England to do a silent retreat. And so I feel myself taking off on the train, you know, just before coming in here earlier, the train of irritability about my mum, you know. And it's just like, don't, just come off that train. Just come off that train. It will happen many times more. I will tell my mum for weeks beforehand, I'm going to do this, and she'll forget, and, you know. And then she gets really irritated because she can't get hold of me when she wants to get hold of me, and all of this. It's like, come off that train before it heads out of the station. Or even maybe it started to go there. I would say the train had started to leave the station today, but the door was still open, so I jumped out just before, you know. Even though they were already saying that announcement, you know. Do not jump off the train when the train is leaving the station. So we can really develop a sort of the body wisdom that we can check in with of finding out what's wholesome and what's not wholesome. It's like we're carrying this with us, this wisdom carriage, the body that's going to tell you always, is this healthy? Not because I'm right, not because someone has done something that they shouldn't do, but is it healthy, what I'm getting into here? You know? And so do I want to go there? And then it's like a feedback loop. Maybe not. Maybe I know this doesn't lead anywhere, so off the train. Another way to come into some embodied practice can be like, say you're in some event, you're at some social event, party, whatever. Someone comes up and says something to you that presses the button of your non-belonging or something that makes you feel kind of insecure, or, you know, you're at some family gathering at Christmas or something like that, and you feel that kind of disappearing thing, you know. And in that moment, it's like kind of almost like a mudslide inside, like this. And in that moment, to really come into your lower belly and to feel your feet on the ground. And that's why we do all this walking meditation, you know. To become familiar with that, to really ground into the body. And then as your usual pattern, maybe just blanking out, and then being used to be able to talk to you like that, suddenly you, oh, actually, no. And you can continue the conversation from a place of embodiedness, of being, yes, I belong. Actually, no, you can't say that. Or, no, I'm not like that. Or whatever it is, whatever the response is that's appropriate, that's not leaving empty your seat at the table. You know? The thing where we blank or disappear because we can't quite feel that we have a place. And then we come back to standing our ground. Not in a defiant way, it's an energetic thing of, no, I am here. And I am okay being myself, just me. And it's that grounding. I'm here, I am here. So I'm kind of mixing, matching here with these belonging teachings and embodied, bodied, and non-self. And I know that that may feel a little bit confusing for people who are hearing some non-self teachings for the first time. And one thing I want to say, to be really clear, is often there's a confusion with non-self teachings because we are basically, most of us here are coming from, Christian, Judeo-Christian backgrounds somehow, even if our parents weren't even Christian, that's our download in this society, you know, this kind of Christian stuff. And there's a lot of that kind of self-effacing in some currents of Christianity. There's not all, there's a lot of far out, incredible Christianity as well. But sometimes there's that, just self-effacing. And it's not the same as non-self. It's not the same thing. I think probably even in the good man Jesus didn't mean it like that. It's a distortion along the way, you know. Of almost suffering, you know. I'll put myself in the suffering sacrificial space instead of saying, no, that's not right for me, or I need this, or being able to say our wishes without that being perceived as arrogant or something. So yeah, really, non-self can really be explored and got into through this these practices of just sitting in meditation and watching the changingness of things. And we're sitting there in our little boat, as I was speaking about the other day, in awareness and just watching something coming up, and we just stay with it, and it changes. A mind state, a strong, intense feeling. Stay with it, meet it. It will leave in its good time. As the cycle of nature, things come to their end, the leaves fall, they go back in the ground. The rain cycle, the sun, us around the sun, the night, the day, you know. There's a lot of impermanence in nature. We've just been through a forest with a lot of decaying wood. Hey, live trees up there and decaying ones down there, and humus, all that rich, fertile humus in the ground. So it's really feeling into, is it constant? When you have a strong feeling, the slam the door feeling, like this. Does it stay? How long does it last? The strong emotion, the strong sense of self in those moments. And so those can be really rich moments, not like, oh, I shouldn't be having those. But those can be really rich moments to slowly start to check out what's it like to be present in those moments. To see, is it strong? Is it a personality, this anger? Is it me? Or is it an emotion passing through like the clouds in the sky in flux? Check it out. try it on. So to go a little bit more into the non-self, it's a bit like my understanding of what the Buddha was saying is it's all the aspects that are actually not us. And that's a hell of a lot of them. And so he was saying, well, we can just say that's not self, and that's not self, and that's not self, and that's not self, and that's not self. So that's like our like our cultural conditioning, our education conditioning, our race conditioning, hemisphere conditioning, we're from the Western Hemisphere. Our gender conditioning, it's a very, very strong one. Age conditioning, around how what we should be doing at a certain age and what we shouldn't, you know what I mean? This kind of thing. It could almost be like there's all these different lights shining on us, different coloured lights. And so you were in the middle of that. On a stage, and there's different light, coloured lights shining on you, above, below, around, different angles, and those are all the conditionings. But they're shining on nothing in the middle. There is, if you take away just, oh, that's just a programming. It's very difficult to find a me in that. That is really solid, that doesn't change, that isn't in flux, to be experimented with. And not to blast out into nihilism, you know, that there's nothing there. We are here with our body. But these are our conditions. Our body made by our parents, by the food we've eaten, you know, by the amount of light and watering we've had, fertilizers. And what can be so fascinating is that getting to know those conditionings, those programmings. And that's what a lot of the Buddhist teachings are about. And back in those days, they didn't have complicated washing machines like nowadays. Like nowadays, the programs on the washing machine it's like, sometimes you've got to really try and work it out, no? How to do it. So sometimes I feel like we're really complicated nowadays, aren't we? We're so complicated with all those programmings we have nowadays. Yet the Buddha gave these incredible teachings that are about programmings back in day when life was, you know, 2,600 years ago, when things were supposedly much simpler. But the humans have always had this complicated story with programming, no? And coming back to things that are not sticking, that's where the questioning can be really interesting to really feel, well, why does that stick? You know, when something is sticking, like really lumpy porridge kind of feeling, why does it stick? What's the programming? What's going on there? What's the habit pattern reaction that I have with that. And they speak often in some traditions, they speak of rebirth a lot. And like you get enlightened and then you don't get reborn anymore. And it can be quite confusing, all of that. And I find that the one of the stripped down versions or ways of looking at it that resonates with me is just the simple, like the sense of self as being born moment by moment, moment by moment. So it's not like the sense of self is some bad thing that we've got to go out hunting and kill, you know. It's part of the human experience. It's not some bad quality that you have or you have and this one, you know. It's just something that we can just very slowly see through its grasp on us, its grip on us. Not to annihilate it, just to let it loosen its grip on us a bit. And then things stick a bit less. So just asking ourselves these questions, is there flux? Are things sticking? Where are they sticking? Why are they sticking? Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? And to be able to see when some patterns of conditioning are kind of like those old socks you don't want to throw away, you know. But maybe it's time. Some layers of old stuff that you can just, I can leave that behind now. You can almost kind of like wriggle out of it, shrug out of some of those old clothes, you know. And they might be something that people are projecting onto you, that you're someone like that. Maybe family is often a difficult area of what's been projected. And you can start on your own, just kind of wriggling out of those old, smelly old clothes, you know. You just leave them on a heap there and say, ciao. I don't need that anymore. And I find that just our own movement of wriggling out of those old patterns, those old conditions we've held on to, often we don't need to say anything to anyone else. You know, then we're right. We're standing in our place. So so meditating to have a taste of this flavor of the not conditioning. The unconditioned. When it gets large and starts to spread out, sometimes it can be a bit scary. It's like that sense of self is dissolving a bit. Now that spreading feeling in meditation where things are more fluid, more breathable. So that's a taste of the unconditioned. And yet, it's it's can be really wholesome to be able to embrace some of the conditioning, you know, to find out what is wholesome within that, in my patterns, in my downloads, what's been downloaded. Some stuff from a few generations has been downloaded into our system. And to know what to sift through, you know, so that we can embrace the sum of the conditioned within our unconditioned. Like, for example, because my family comes from they're like white colonialists who went to South Africa, you know. So I've always been quite ashamed of that background and have kind of pushed that ancestral past away as, oh, I don't want to know them, you know. And if I hear an accent like that, I go, those racist, weird people. But part of my journey towards embracing part of my conditions of where I'm coming from, like befriending, making friends again with the difficult bits, has been recognizing those downloads in myself that come from there, you know. So sure, some of them were really, and they still are, and I don't know them, but some of them are really racist, freaky people, you know. I mean, South Africa is the top class, you know, racist, supreme quality racism of the world, you know. Some of them are like that. And some of them are pretty amazing people, you know, to go off into the African bush with a cart and survive and to create farms in the middle of nowhere. You know, it takes some resourcefulness and some ingenuity. And sometimes I see some of that download and go, well, I got it from those funny people. So it's helpful for me now, you know, some of that resourcefulness and ingenuity. Doesn't mean I have to behave like them, but, and that for me is part of befriending that, you know, those generational downloads that we don't really want often. I think I've said it already, anyways. I have difficulty sticking to what I write sometimes. So I think I've said I've said my say, and I would love to hear how this resonates with you, and if you have anything to share to do with this or something else or that you would like to ask to offer into the space here. Yeah.
I'm from South Africa, so I know the other side of the point of racism. I live in Britain now and have done for 15 years, and I see that side of the racism of Brexit. And I understand when you say the non-self, and I understand that, but there are certain things I struggle with, like injustices of the world, even things like bullying.
Yeah.
You know, and then I don't know how to see it as non-self. Like I get very attached to those levels of injustices. But like if my mother first when annoys me, I'm angry, I get I can see the non-self. But I think the major thing is I can't see the non-self.
Yeah, thank you, that's brilliant. Yeah. But... In a way, that's what I was talking about standing your ground, you know, of standing in your place. Because non-self, it doesn't mean not existing. It doesn't mean getting out of the way in a selfless, I'll just let myself be walked over, or I'll let injustices happen. If you have it to manifest in this world, against injustices, that's great. No? You could do that. No problem. You could do it with an attitude of non-self. But somebody who was going to go and start to try to help the world and who has a lot of sense of self would basically be on an ego trip. You know what I mean? About saving the world. And might be quite dictatorial with the other people. Do you see what I mean? It's like I've actually heard these stories of people who work for big charities and who were like, you know, really high up in the hierarchy and who are really oppressive people. Because they're coming from a... And I'm not saying all, I've just heard some stories. because they're coming, their action isn't coming from understanding what is not self. It's coming from a desire to get credit to themselves more, you know? So you can do anything. You can manifest in incredible ways. We all need to manifest somehow on this planet, no? As ourself is the best way. No? And not trying to be someone else, but just to be yourself in all of your beauty and strength and belonging. It doesn't mean sitting down and lying down and being inactive at all. But if you... if you were to go and get it, I don't know if you do, if you are involved in charities or what. If you were, and then you, it was all about you, you know, that would be coming from a different energy, no? It's like a few years ago, I was in, and I meant no offense with South African people, hey. No, I just meant that the really white colonialist, racist people, they freak me out, you know.
They are crazy.
They are crazy, aren't they? They're really crazy people, yeah.
But you should visit, it's amazing.
I've been, I've worked there, I've lived there. Yeah. I'm also born in Africa, so I kind of grew up with all that stuff. You know?
African son.
Yeah. Would you like to say more?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
But it's a, you know, that the seeing into what is non-self, it's a, you can spend your whole life doing it, you know? It's not a, like an instant, get a little bit of understanding and then 15 years later a little bit more understanding. And it's like we keep chipping away at it, you know? We keep coming in like a... almost like a spiral like this that's getting deeper and deeper. So sometimes I think, well, I'm not eroding the sense of self. I'm not seeing through it. And then I go, no, it's just that the challenges that come up now are bigger than what I could have coped with before. So as you get more into practice, so do the challenges get stronger sometimes. So you're going deeper in the spiral and things stick less. And then you're like, wow, this is full on what I'm dealing with now. Whew. Lucky this didn't happen 15 years ago. Jesus, you know. So it's it needs a lot of patience and love, you know, to be willing to just let that water drop on the stone, you know, to wear it out. To come into a place where you can go, yes, I am here. Without the grip, the inner holding, gripping onto the me, you know, who needs to defend, who has so much me to defend. It's that feeling, you know, where someone says something and, yes, but I, you know. It's that, your bottom lip at, you know. And that's very different from creating boundaries, where we just need to say no to someone, firmly. No, you can't do that to me. Sorry, you know. It's a very different feeling, that a clear boundary, from recognizing the feeling of a strong sense of self being grasped as really real. This indignation is really righteous and I have every right to it, you know. It's a very different feeling. Yeah, please.
I think sometimes that sense of fight against injustice comes from unhealed wounds in ourselves.
Mm.
So, what people want to... It's whether it's your mother or it's the world, it's the same wound in yourself. And so, if you're... A lot of people out there trying to change the world, but actually it's... The pain they're feeling is their own unhealed wounds, which is why we have to go in and pay attention to those. And then you can come back and meet injustice, etc., from a place of calmness, connectivity, and love, rather than reactivity.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just different for different people, huh? Some people, maybe they recognise that and they do go to big work on themselves and their wounds, and other people do it whilst... during, in a, this kind of way, and then kind of helping to heal the world is helping to heal them, that is helping to heal their wounds, that is, you know, it can be a,
yeah, it can be a fuel,
a circularity.
Yeah,
thank you. Yeah. I think Dan wanted to say something.
I think I've just got a seriously foggy brain on you, been talking about it for ages, but I still haven't grasped the concept of non-self.
That's okay. Takes years. But it takes a long time, and I can't like stand and declare that I've understood either. You know, I just try. I try and understand, and then I try and share that. But which could just be a kind of mad thing to do. But maybe just try and feel those moments when you feel a very strong sense of meanness. Just that you can begin very slowly to practice that. Oh, that very strong sense of me. And then as... You Doug, no? You Doug?
Me?
Yeah. No. What's your name?
Andy.
Andy, sorry. I haven't got everyone's names because I haven't met everyone yet. As Andy was saying... about wounds, you know, sometimes things can get mixed up with the wounds that we're carrying, and we need to know when it's a wound that needs attending, and when it's your kind of everyday sense of self. Like the teacher that Sumedha has been speaking about has been an influence on me since I'm like 23, 24 years old, and, you know, I've really, really taken to heart his teachings. And when he started to get quite oppressive with the nuns when I lived in this monastery with Sumedha. And one morning I was in the temple and he was giving a talk at 5 a.m. and he said, he was talking about non-self and identities and grasping identities. And he said, but you can even get into the get really into grasping the identity of being Jewish or homosexual. And I was just like, yeah, but maybe you've never been in a minority position, you know? Maybe you've always been the white male monk with mm-hmm. all the privileges, mm-hmm. and that's why you talk like that, because you don't have the compassion, you know, of what it might feel like to be more vulnerable, and that defensiveness that we have, where we're standing up to exist, for our right to exist as someone who's a bit different, you know. You normally hear the people that are talking about, let's not do labels and let's not, let's, all of that's just, you know, just labels are normally someone in a minority, majority position of privilege. So recognizing what is the wound and how to work with the wound, and where is your everyday kind of sense of self happening. That's it. Is that a long answer?
Very.
How's the fog? Between here and over there.
Still very foggy, but I'll... Yeah, it's okay. It's just foggy.
Yeah. Okay. Bit by bit, huh? Mm-hmm. Through the fog. I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to share, I don't know if it might help you as well, about how... what you've explained about non-self and how I related to it. Yesterday, when we were doing the mantras, I really loved the chanting and the mantras, and I get that sense of that contentment that Sumedha was talking about yesterday, yeah. of that middle way of just being. And then during the mantras, I got this really huge panic, and I couldn't breathe, and I was crying, and I thought I needed to leave. And I was like, what's going on? And I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness,
mm-hmm.
and that was really tricky for me to, like, move away.
Mm.
And I'm not disowned by my family, but I'm very distant, and I realised that, and it happened to me at a flute festival last summer, where I suddenly thought, like, it was the devil getting me, because it's, like, false religion and stuff like that is seen as that you're going to go to hell, you're not going to make it, it's the devil trying to turn you against God. Yes. And I was sitting here, like, really confused. I was like, oh, that contentment. I was like, the devil's coming to get me, this is awful, I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
And I've been reflecting on it and what you were saying about, I've been trying to think about, because I'm on this spiritual path, but I feel very restricted by this religious conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were talking about non-self, my partner always talks to me about it, and I never understand it, like you have always been like, and then I realised in that feeling of panic and fear and upset and guilt and shame of this contentment isn't me, it's someone else.
Oh.
And by understanding that that's not me, I can separate myself from it, and I'm like, oh, okay, and now I understand boundaries and thinking. But yeah, I just really wanted to share. So yeah, it feels like I understand a bit better now.
That's a really amazing example. Far out, thank you.
I don't know if it helps you to.
I'm just impressed to survive.
Did you want to say something, Ali?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do you think there's a place for kind of like a striving goal-oriented practice? And I ask because I've kind of...
No, say a bit slower again, please.
Do you think there's a place for like a kind of striving and kind of goal-oriented style of practice? And I ask because I've noticed a big split between different traditions, and some really emphasize kind of meditative depth and kind of getting to a kind of insight into not self, and then after that everything will be great. And you know, they often don't say it so simplistically, but that's the kind of message. And then other traditions which kind of don't talk so much about this meditative depth, they kind of talk more about kind of an integrated practice. And I really, you know, I feel like there's some kind of integration that can happen, but I do wonder, are these like two different paths? And you know, it's a big question in my practice, like, should I put in a lot of energy into this practice, or kind of go the kind of more relaxed route? And yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah. It's quite a big question, though, energy and effort. How effort in spiritual practice. And it's very variable, you know what I mean? There's no one answer. for this whole room of people. Mm. That I think there's not even one answer for this one alley, you know? Mm. I could say for myself that I've had different moments. There's been moments when I've really gone at it and put a lot of energy, and moments when I've sat back a bit more. And those can also be very fruitful, the sit back a bit. There's also recognizing that often we bring our own tendencies into spiritual practice. So somebody who's very achiever, goal-orientated, a very driven person, will often find after some time that that's how they're meditating in that same way. And somebody is very like, ah, just let go and just wait for it all to happen. You know, that's often how they meditate. So we're bringing our life habits into meditation. And there's a moment when sometimes you can go, oh, that's my life habit that I'm meditating. And is it appropriate or not?
Mm-hmm.
So that's response number two. I'd say number three is also we are each on a unique path. You know, we can get into a tradition, we could get into a few traditions or open spirituality or whatever. But each person's journey is so unique and what they need.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need now, I don't know. I think that's up to you really to check it out.
I think the more integrated practice.
Yeah, I think you know actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you can practice with daily life more.
Yeah.
Instead of making a separation between meditation practice and then you have your life. Mm. And it's all like normal. Oh, and now I do my meditation. Now I'm the meditation person. Oh, now I'm the other person. You know, to be able to... But we're talking a lot about that, Sumedha and I, that embodied practice, you know. Just walking to your car, going to the toilet, you know, blowing your nose. Not like a superhero of awareness, you know, with an awareness cape, you know. The big A here, no? Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be like that, the superhero stuff.
I guess for me there's kind of part of practice is, yeah, to kind of integrate into my daily life and kind of, you know, just to, you know, have that suffering, basically.
Mm.
But there's another side which is just deeply curious about death. And I think this is what I mean. Like, there's practices which I feel like are really useful and healthy for me. But then there's practices which I'm just very curious about. And it's like kind of bringing that in and like having that awareness of death, but like not freaking out, basically. And it's like, is that possible to kind of have that kind of exploratory side and take kind of insights and then also have a kind of integrated life?
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
I'd go for it. I'd go for it. Go for it 100%. And sometimes you need the conditions, you know. Sometimes you want to go in really deep. Go to Burma to a monastery for 3 months where they meditate 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. That's a bit painful.
But maybe it's not. You know, there are moments to go, yes, I do want to dive in that deep end and to choose that. Or, you know, in Nepal, there's a place you can go, and some Christians have a place with a cave you can stay in, and they'll bring you food and whatever. There's so many ways of doing that in depth, or staying in a place, in a spiritual center, or reading all of the spiritual books, the Quran, the Bible, and everything, on a boat journey for 6 months. Whatever form it takes, that the thirst to go in deep was, I would say, yes, go. And some people really take up that kind of practice. I think of this monk, Ajahn Mun, who's long passed, from the Thai forest tradition. And I've only ever seen a photo of him on the wall in the monastery, of him looking very austere. He was kind of like that. And I'd be going, oh, I'm having breakfast with Ajahn Mun this morning. Ajahn Mun, not feeling good about today. But I read about him, and that he would wake up, and the minute that his eyelids were open at 3 a.m, he would jump out of bed and start doing walking meditation. You know, that was the beginning of his practice, and he would just practice all day. You know, like not a moment of spacing out and TV and delusion or anything like that. Ooh, la, la. So that's a path, you know. I think about Ajahn Mun when I'm lying in bed, going, can't quite get to it. Will I ever get to that leaping out of bed and start walking before I've even opened my eyes? Yeah.
I have a question. So, I don't really know where, it's about meditation, I don't really know where to place it within the five categories you were talking about.
Uh-huh.
Usually when I try to meditate, my mind is always, if it's not speaking about something, it's planning something, if it's not doing that, it's singing something, it's like there's always something going on. Mm. And I try to do, like you said, I just go with it and see where it goes. It keeps on going. It will go for like an hour or so.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop, so I don't really know how to quiet it down. And even when I think it's quiet, like I keep it for like a few minutes, and then like the song comes back.
That's the plague of musicians, no? In meditation, the song keeps coming back. But I think it's that thing with the train, you know, and the wholesome, unwholesome. Hey, it's an wholesome or unwholesome train to be on?
I don't feel like I have a choice though, because it keeps, I don't know how to get off.
But then maybe you need to find a different technique, as Sumedha was speaking about yesterday, was it? You know, there are different techniques to come off the compulsive train. And one is to just, like really just focus on the tongue on the top of the mouth and try to bring your mind back to just focusing on one thing. Okay. Or you could try to distract it with something else. To get off the train, just to get off the train, you know, to cut into that cycle that you're spinning on. You could try a distraction by bringing another thought in. So you could go look for a wholesome train of thought and go, okay, I'm going to think about I don't know what, something that feels wholesome, to distract from that churning mind, you know, that just keeps going on and on about the same thing. And I find actually that the kind of widening awareness where we just bring in what's coming in now, what's coming in this moment, if I close my eyes, what's coming in from outside? And sometimes it's the sound of a car, someone breathing there, the bird, you know? That's one way. And another way is also, if you're having thoughts, is to see what the thoughts are doing to the space, you know? So if the thought is a train going through a tunnel or under the sea or something, what's it doing to that space? So you're not so interested in the train, but you're more interested in the space. The effect of the train going through, the effect of that thought on your body, mind, heart. How does it feel? You can get really curious about that. And I find that's really helpful. And another one, if you can remember all these, is trying to actually catch the thought to see how solid it is. And this, I call it my catching the fish meditation. Because when you actually try to get the thought to see how solid it is, to see what it is composed of inside, it slips out of your hand. Often. And suddenly it's disappeared because you're trying to catch it suddenly. And then it's disappeared. But it's the thing of not being so interested in the story it wants to tell. You know? So you try these different things. Yeah. I think these are the last question, yeah? For the road.
We've got a question. Hey? We've got a question this evening.
Yeah, and we've got questions this evening. Yeah.
Can you clarify what you're talking about with the addiction conversation? You were talking about the relationship with smoking. Is it the quality of perception of you just got into smoking so much that you just embody the quality of smoking to the point where you just knew it wasn't good for you? Is that what you were saying?
No. Hang on, let me read.
Yeah. Talking about, you know, smoking outside
the caravan. I think what I was saying was that I believed that my identity as an addicted smoker was really real, was really solid. For so long, I believed that it was hard work to give up because I really believed that I was a person who couldn't give up, who was addicted, with all of the shortcomings that I associated with that, with the feelings of embarrassment and shame, of not strong, weak person, da-di-da-di-da. I believe that story about myself. I believe that constructed identity. And through getting into the teachings of non-self, I got into feeling rocking identities of that sort in that situation and actually went, oh, well, that's just a belief. It's a belief that I'm an addicted person that's weak and that can't ever let go of something and that needs to do this, blah, blah, blah. And the seeing through the belief, it just really just dropped away quite suddenly. And then I was left with what I'd been smoking for, which was often to cover up emotions. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I found myself going, wow, I've lived for 35 years and I don't know how to have emotions, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been putting a lid on them. I don't know my emotions. But I was like, okay, but I'm ready now. Okay. So at this late age in my life, I'm going to start to get to know my emotions. And I'm still getting to know them. But so that's what was scary, is that uncovering suddenly of what I'd been tampering down, what I'd been putting a lid on, was really scary. And to no longer fear that, to go, okay, I'm ready for this journey into... Yeah? So, yeah, we're having a questions and answers tonight, hey? If people feel like writing on a piece of paper and putting them in the bowl here, then we'll do that at what time? At dunno time?
we can do a little set.
Yeah, I'd just like to say thank you for all your aliveness and presence and actually making the talk with me, even if mainly I talk or have been talking. Actually, it's there's a together there. I can feel you participating. That actually makes the talk. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.